Welcome. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Thank you for joining us for this year's virtual National Lawyers Convention, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. All panels were recorded live via Zoom and have been turned into audio podcasts. For more information about the 2020 National Lawyers Convention or about the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the continuation of our convention and to our address from Secretary of Labor Eugene Scalia. Secretary Scalia has had a long and distinguished career. He not only the Secretary of Labor, he was former Solicitor of Labor, so knew a lot about it from that. He was the he worked at the law firm Gibson Dunn for years. He was in law school at the University of Chicago Law School. He has played a he's played the key role as secretary, which all secretaries play, of overseeing 180 federal employment laws, which cover 150 million workers and 10 million workplaces. It's quite a job, and he's been a strong advocate, among other things, for removing unnecessary regulations. He's also been a good friend of the Federalist Society, spoke to last year's convention, and we are honored to have him. We're especially honored, given our history and our interest, to have him speaking from the desk, his desk of the Secretary of Labor, which is the desk of his father, Justice Scalia, which he, I guess, brought over to the department and is using that. But we are very, very pleased to have him here. And without further ado, I want to turn it over to Secretary Scalia.
Gene, thank you for that introduction. And it's an honor to address this year's National Lawyers Convention. Every 4 years, these Federal Society meetings are even more lively than usual as we appraise a presidential term that's ending in a recent election and speculate about what lies ahead for the executive branch, Congress, and the courts. Of course, in one big way, things are very different this year. The convention is virtual, so sadly, all of you are going to have to get by this year without attending the greatest black tie legal geek fest on planet Earth. That said, the current presidential term is one of the most memorable and most consequential in decades. Than most years, it gives Federalist Society members a lot to talk about and a lot to celebrate, starting with the courts. President Trump has more than 50 federal appellate judges and nearly 160 district judges. And it's not just the quantity that impresses, it's the quality. These are men and women with sterling qualifications and exceptional ability. 5 former clerks for Justice Scalia, 11 for Justice Thomas. Apparently, the Thomas clerks have a harder time making it in the private sector than the Scalia clerk. Altogether, more than 30 former Supreme Court clerks have been appointed to the bench. President Trump has confounded his critics in a number of ways, and here's one. He filled the courts with the most impressive assembly of justices, of jurists appointed by any president in our lifetimes. As much as the great Ronald Reagan transformed the courts, even he did not consistently appoint judges of the caliber of President Trump's. Credit for this goes partly to the Federalist Society, though not for reasons commonly supposed. This organization, meetings like this, and a few jurists, foremost among them perhaps my father, have for 40 years led a conversation about legal interpretation and the role of the courts that has brought a convergence around a set of principles that now guide American jurisprudence. President Trump can appoint great judges in part because of the consensus about what a great judge is. That consensus, which had only started to emerge or reemerge in the Reagan administration, has now shaped and will guide President Trump's appointees. It was forged in part in meetings like this. Well, while I'm on the subject, I suppose I should say a word or two about the president's most recent judicial appointment, one of them, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. The Scalia family takes particular pride in the first former Scalia clerk to join the court. I believe she will be an exceptional justice and an exceptional example to the American people in multiple ways. She joins two other impressive Supreme Court appointments of the president. Though the proof will lie in the decisions they issue over decades, and while we cannot be certain now, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Barrett may together constitute one of the greatest impacts any president has had on American law. And of course, credit goes also to Majority Leader McConnell, who has made confirming judges a priority throughout this administration. We have been fortunate to work with one of the most effective congressional leaders in American history. Now, Leader McConnell is an unassuming man and would be quick to point out the extent to which he has just built on the work of those who came before him. So, Harry Reid, thank you for eliminating the judicial filibuster. Well, I've mentioned Ronald Reagan, in whose administration I was privileged to serve. Allow me to compare the Trump administration to Reagan's in another way that's important to many members of the Federal Society, restraining the administrative state. This administration's steps to reduce federal regulatory burdens have been the most important since the cost-benefit analysis requirements of the Reagan administration, and they've been even more comprehensive. The effort began with an executive order just days after inauguration, which required agencies to remove two regulatory burdens for every new one they added, and required agencies to set regulatory budgets of no net cost increase. This order was followed by two others regarding use of guidance documents. One required all guidance documents to be posted online in a searchable database and to be rescinded if they're no longer needed or valid. The order also required all significant guidance to go through notice and comment. Finally, this past spring, the president issued an executive order setting forth a, quote, regulatory bill of rights, principles for agencies to follow to help ensure regulated parties are treated fairly and receive due process. At the Labor Department, we've sought to do our part to reduce unwarranted burdens, increase regulatory clarity, and ensure fair process. Since the start of the administration, we estimate that our rules account for $15 billion in cost savings. Over the past nearly 4 years, we've averaged 9 deregulatory rules for every regulatory rule we've adopted. A simple example, a rule we adopted earlier this year that lets retirement plans provide statements to plan participants electronically unless the participant affirmatively indicates he wants a paper copy. We estimate the rule will save $3 billion and a whole lot of trees. We issued another rule this year to codify a clear and reasonable standard for determining when a joint employment relationship exists. We hope the clarity it brings will encourage legitimate business models like franchising that would otherwise be deterred by threats of costly litigation. A federal judge in New York vacated key parts of that rule, and we've now appealed. In the same vein, we're currently working on a rule interpreting independent contractor under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's the minimum wage and overtime law. Our goal is to clarify, simplify, and harmonize principles federal courts have used for decades to determine who's an employee and who instead is an independent contractor and business firm himself. We want to ensure that employees receive the protections due them under the FLSA. And we also want to respect the desire many Americans have to be their own boss. I view our rule in part as a counterweight to AB 5, the California law that radically redefined independent contractor status in that state, and which has been so disliked, including by workers, that the state legislature felt compelled to riddle it with amendments to allow dozens of exemptions for particular jobs. Last week, California voters delivered their own referendum on AB 5, approving a ballot initiative backed by app-based transportation and delivery companies that exempts them from AB 5 while requiring that they provide certain additional benefits. That vote in California is a strong warning to progressives who believe that Americans want radical changes in our employment laws. I'd like to talk about something now that's critically important that we've learned from this administration's economic program. The economic and regulatory policies of the Obama and Trump administrations are a study in contrasts. One of this president's principal aims was to cut the taxes and regulations of his predecessor. The administration has done so vigorously, and we have a growing body of evidence on the relative impacts of Obama and Trump's policies on American workers. This includes data from my department's Bureau of Labor Statistics and from important retrospective reports issued in September by the Census Bureau and by the Federal Reserve. What I'll relate from these reports should be at the center of future debates about the benefits for workers of limited government. The mainstream media would have you believe that President Obama was a president who lifted the working man and woman, the little guy. The data show he failed. For nearly five full years under President Obama, the unemployment rate was above 7%. By contrast, during the pandemic, we brought unemployment back under 7% in half a year. The Obama presidency was a long, slow climb out of the Great Recession, the weakest post-recession recovery since World War II. And as that administration ended, prognosticators expected the middling economic performance to continue. In August 2016, the Congressional Budget Office projected 1.9 million new jobs from January 2017 to the start of this year. And CBO projected that we'd be at around 5% unemployment at the start of the year. Something totally different happened. Instead of 1.9 million jobs, nearly 7 million jobs were created in that three-year period. Unemployment wasn't 5% at the start of the year, it was 3.5, a 50-year low. We've been below 4% unemployment since 2000, but in this administration, we logged about two full years at 4% or lower. Meanwhile, wages grew at 3% or greater for more than a year and a half. The last time wage growth was above 3% was all the way back in April 2009. What changed after August 2016 when the CBO had projected lackluster growth? The president changed. Policies changed. Talk to business people. Tax cuts fueled investment and pay raises, and deregulation fostered growth. Among the principal beneficiaries of this economy were Americans who historically have faced more challenges in the workplace. The unemployment rate and poverty rate for African Americans, Asian Americans, and Hispanic Americans hit record lows last year. Wage gains in 2019 were greater for these three groups than for non-Hispanic whites. Unemployment for adult women hit a nearly 70-year low earlier this year. Nearly 70% of new non-farm jobs in 2019 went to women. What about a top concern for progressives, income inequality? In the Obama administration, from 2010 to 2016, real net worth declined 2% for families in the lowest quintile of income earners, while it rose 24% for families in the top decile. But from 2016 to 2019, the Federal Reserve tells us, those results flipped. The top decile of wage earners actually saw a modest decline in net worth, while the lowest earning families saw their net worth jump 32%, a 32% increase in 3 years. Women's wages grew three times the rate of men's in 2019. In short, under President Obama's policies, the income gap grew. Under President Trump, it narrowed. For American workers, lower unemployment, higher wages, and greater equity were the result of the administration's tax and regulatory policies. It's a lesson we should never forget. That historic economy was sideswiped by the pandemic, but we're already in a strong recovery, more than 12 million jobs added since April, and unemployment nearly 8 points lower than its April peak, lower already at 6.9% than it was for 5 years under President Obama. This is a far faster rebound than anybody was predicting back in April. We still have work to do, and millions we need to help return safely to work. But our economic rebound is a testament in part to the firm economic footing we had as we confronted the virus. But keep an eye on the following. Through September, super regulator states like California, New York, and Illinois were having a much harder time bringing unemployment down than the rest of the country. In September, the last month for which we have state data, the unemployment rate in California was 11%. In New York and Illinois, it was approximately 10%. The national average that month was 7.9%. And of course, since California, New York, and Illinois are three of our five largest states, they were weighing down that national average. The majority of states were at 6.7% unemployment or lower in September. Nationally in September, we had restored more than 50% of the jobs lost since March. But in California, just 38% of jobs had been restored and less than 30% of manufacturing jobs. We don't yet know all the reasons for these discrepancies or how long lasting they will be, but we know this. Coronavirus highlighted our federal system of government and the impact of state and local decisions. The virus also accelerated some changes that otherwise might have occurred over a longer period of time. Perhaps one of those is that businesses, as they reopen and reinvest, are concentrating growth in states they find more hospitable. Just one last observation on the employment data from September and October. Private sector jobs growth was strong, with 900,000 jobs approximately added back both months. But a major drag on job growth was in the education sector, where hundreds of thousands of jobs were lost when you account for seasonal adjustment. The American people already know that teachers' unions and districts across the country acted against students' interests by making school reopening more difficult than warranted. In the post-coronavirus reckoning, it will be interesting to examine the effect of that behavior on employment. Employment in the education sector and employment for those who count on their school, on their children being at school during the workday. Well, the benefits for workers during this administration were not incidental. They were intended, with workers at the heart of a number of administration initiatives. A prime example is the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, USMCA. The president has said that replacing NAFTA was a principal reason he ran for office in 2016. There was a broad consensus that NAFTA needed to be renegotiated. President Trump got it done, with unprecedented support from business as well as organized labor and from the vast majority of both Republicans and Democrats in Congress. A key component of USMCA is labor protections that level the playing field for American workers. The head of the United Nations International Labor Organization has said that USMCA has the strongest labor protections of any international trade agreement ever. It promotes trade while protecting American workers from non-US companies getting an unfair advantage through exploitative working conditions. Projections are that USMCA will lead to up to 500,000 US jobs or more in the years ahead. USMCA is part of an emphasis on US manufacturing that itself has been a hallmark of the Trump presidency. Of the nearly 7 million jobs added during the pandemic, nearly 500,000 were in manufacturing. President Obama didn't think that could be done. He was resigned to a shrinking manufacturing capacity and mocked Trump's goal of rebuilding manufacturing, asking, quote, "What magic wand do you have?" Well, the magic of tax cuts and deregulation, it turned out, of hard bargaining for better trade agreements, the magic of respecting blue-collar manufacturing work and the vocational education and apprenticeships that prepare people for those jobs. I can tell you one of the pleasures of my job as labor secretary has been visiting these workplaces and meeting with workers and apprentices who are enjoying the benefits of holding a good-paying job, a good-paying manufacturing job in a vibrant economy. Many of the administration's policies that supported workers were favored by business, but some were opposed. One area of difference is a rule we issued at the department to correct some of our foreign worker programs, including the H-1B program. These programs are for companies to bring foreign workers to the U.S. to complement, not replace, U.S. workers. But the program's protections for American workers have atrophied. And sometimes companies use these programs not to supplement their U.S. workforce, but to displace it. To address that, the department is raising the wages required to be paid to these foreign workers, so the wages are on par with what Americans make for the same work. By doing this, we're reducing the incentive for employers to hire foreign workers over their American counterparts. Foreign worker programs play an important role in our economy, and immigration, legal immigration, formed this nation and lies at the core of our national identity. But Congress did not intend foreign worker programs to serve as a means to import less expensive foreign labor to displace U.S. workers. And I found abuses in these programs that need to be fixed. Well, some pundits like to depict Federal Society members and their beliefs as indistinguishable from the preferences of big business. The truth, as Federal Society members know, is that adherence to the framers' vision, the Constitution, and the rule of law don't mean obeisance to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Look no farther than the Federal Society's name. As a young associate, I quickly realized that my corporate clients wanted simple, uniform, national rules. They may love our Constitution, but federalism, it can be a hassle. Or take another example. I'm with my father in the BMW v. Gore case, that the Fourth Amendment's Due Process Clause is not, quote, a secret repository of substantive guarantees against the unfairness of an excessive civil compensatory award, nor the unfairness of an unreasonable punitive damage award, end quote. This past year at the department, we certainly saw matters where fidelity to statutory commands or to constitutional principles furthered workers' interests while creating some friction with sectors of the business community. One involved so-called ESG investing, making investment decisions based in part on environmental and social factors or corporate governance. Obviously, these factors, at least the E and the G, are sometimes material investment considerations. In the case of a costly Superfund site, for example, or a dysfunctional board of directors. But some activists and some companies promote ESG investing as a way to advance policy goals like addressing global warming or promoting gun control. And in a totally fortuitous coincidence, ESG factors often track left of center political priorities. ESG proponents can spin some pretty elaborate theories about the benefits that will spring from various investments or divestments. But I don't know that I've yet seen them propose a particular investment strategy because, for example, it would strengthen religious faith, preserve two-parent households, or reduce out-of-wedlock births, all of which correlate with better educational outcomes and accordingly a more productive workforce. Although in fairness, in an annual letter this year, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink did side with the Catholic Church, specifically a 2019 pronouncement by the Vatican on, of all things, carbon pricing. As a Catholic, I'm taking this as a very encouraging sign. If successful liberal investors are looking to the Pope for pricing strategies, just think how carefully liberals will listen to the church on matters within what you and I consider to be its core competencies. Individuals can, of course, pursue whatever investment strategies they want with their own money. But the Labor Department has oversight of private pension plans managed by fiduciaries for the benefit of retirees. We recently finalized a rule making clear that ERISA fiduciaries cannot use pension assets to pursue their own policy goals. Their decisions must be based exclusively on pecuniary considerations intended to maximize investment returns. while our rule received a lot of support, there was pushback from some financial firms that market ESG-themed investment funds. And some ESG proponents argued for investment strategies that pursue nebulous social goods. One said that asset managers should see themselves as, quote, universal owners dedicated to furthering broad policy goals rather than focusing on the performance of individual investments. Another commenter said that, quote, collective action by investors was needed to, quote, manage social and environmental systems. And several Democratic letters complained that our rule would undermine a powerful tool that leverages trillions of dollars a year to drive positive social change. That sort of proved our point. Retirees' pensions aren't there to be leveraged to drive some people's vision of positive social change. In the words of another observer, the director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, who formerly was on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, pension fund investing is not the place to solve the ills of the world. Rather, by law, our nation's private pension plans further one and only one incredibly important social good, a financially secure retirement. And so our rule sides with retirees, not with the ambitions that some elites may have for the use of retirees' funds. Another area where the administration had some disagreement with some large corporations had to do with discrimination. In September, the president signed an executive order barring federal agencies and contractors from giving workplace training that the order called sex or race stereotyping or scapegoating. This is workplace training that attributes particular traits or status to someone because of his or her race or sex, as well as training programs that assign blame or bias to someone just again because of that person's race or sex. The order was motivated by training at some federal agencies, like one which taught that, quote, virtually all white people, regardless of how woke they are, contribute to racism, end quote. Or listen to this from training at a federal laboratory. That training said, emphasizing rationality over emotionality was a characteristic of white males. Again, putting rationality over emotionality is a characteristic of white men. Do you know how furious that makes a half Irish, half Italian cabinet secretary who's perfectly capable of blowing his stack for no good reason? Well, in conjunction with the president's executive order, the Labor Department invited employers and workers to voluntarily submit training materials that might raise questions under this order. We've learned that one healthcare company tells workers that its training will, quote, minimize the potential for harm your whiteness has on others, end quote. They make it sound like some kind of kryptonite. An aerospace company invites its workers to ask, why is it so hard for white people to talk about racism, end quote. Well, maybe it's hard because people running some of these training sessions are demanding that white employees admit they're racist. And here's what one construction company tells its workers, quote, the pressure to avoid white privilege is great, for in facing it, I must give up the myth of meritocracy. And if these things are true, this is not such a free country. And again, end quote. So you thought you were walking into a class about equality and non-discrimination, but instead your employer is telling you that you're blinded by your race. There's no real meritocracy in the U.S. And in fact, we're not much of a free country. From my time at the Labor Department, from decades as an employment lawyer, and simply being in the workplace, I know that discrimination persists. Training about non-discrimination and equal opportunity is important. The Labor Department encourages it. And in some instances, we require it. There's value, too, in training that emphasizes the worth of people of diverse races and creeds. But few things are clearer than that we do not end racism by promoting racial stereotypes, nor does racism end by teaching shame and envy based on race. While principles of equal treatment and non-discrimination may be out of favor in some sophisticated circles, we got a resounding affirmation in last week's elections from the American people. Earlier, I mentioned one strong message to progressives in the election, California's rejection of AB5's treatment of certain app-based companies. A second message was delivered by Proposition 16, which would have repealed the state's 1996 referendum that requires non-discrimination in state programs, and therefore bars certain forms of affirmative action that give preferential treatment to one person over another because of their races. Californians voted against repeal, 56% of them did. Their vote reflects the abiding power of the elementary principle of non-discrimination. The year since this group last met has been tumultuous, but in that turbulence, some bedrocks have been visible and even fortified. Scores of new judges have been appointed, including a justice, who pledge faith to a constitution whose text and original meaning define and delimit judges' role in our democracy. We saw further powerful demonstration of the link between liberty and prosperity, an affirmation that establishing the conditions for a booming economy is the single best thing the government can do for American workers. And in a year where our nation's founding ideals and framers were attacked and disparaged by mobs and sophisticates, we've seen how the American people continue to cherish the framers' vision of this great, exceptional country. Thank you, and thank you for all the Federal Society does to further our founders' Constitution.
Thank you so much, Secretary Scalia. Really, really appreciate that and your talk. I think we probably have just a few minutes for questions, if that's for me to ask a couple questions, if that's okay.
Please.
Let me start out by saying, what is sort of the most challenging area in labor and employment policy, do you think, over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, there are a number. Certainly one, Gene, that gets a lot of attention and raises some genuine issues. It has to do with an issue I was talking about, and that's independent contractors, what appear to be a growing number of workers who aren't in a traditional employee-employer relationship, which again is something that many people want. It gives more flexibility, freedom, and can involve being your own boss. Although, again, I hasten to add, there are some employers that characterize people who really are their employees as instead being independent contractors. So again, it's a legitimate status for many people, but it doesn't carry some of the benefits that come with the employment relationship. For example, healthcare, retirement care. And I think you can support independent contractor status, but still want to identify ways to ensure that these people have security as well. We proposed a rule, finalized a rule at the Labor Department a couple years ago that one of the things it did was address that. It was what we called our association health plan rule. And it made it easier for small employers and individual sole proprietors to pool together their resources to buy healthcare and use the leverage that they had through numbers to drive better rates and healthcare that was better tailored to their needs or their employees' needs. That rule actually it was argued in the DC Circuit more than a year ago. We're awaiting a decision. It's a remarkably long wait. But that's the kind of thing I think warrants consideration moving forward. We may be having a growing number of workers who are independent contractors. We can respect that status, but we should continue to think about ways to provide them benefits or enable them to provide benefits for themselves, a bit along the lines of what happens in the employment relationship.
Yeah, interesting. The obviously another one proposition in California was the whole Uber proposition. Yeah, I guess another question which occurs to me is that within the area of employment issues, organization that perhaps should take advantage of this opportunity to ask, what is it that the Federal Society or our members might specifically want to be aware of, or might, or we might want to focus more of our programming on, or in some way or other the Federal Society ought to pay more attention to?
A lot of what we do at the Labor Department is visible to the public, to litigators, to lawyers advising clients. Very large part of our budget, about three quarters of our budget, goes to training programs, apprenticeships, training for young people, training for people who've lost jobs and are trying to develop new skills for potentially a different career. That's more than a $9 billion part of our budget. That's less scrutinized. It's something that your average lawyer would be less familiar with. But as I said, the dollars involved are great. And there are challenges in that area in making sure that when we're spending all that money, how can we be sure that it's being used effectively? So that's actually been an issue that I've spent a fair amount of time on as secretary, seeing that the American people get the bang for their buck in those kinds of training programs, focusing more on performance measurements, and finding ways to reward those who perform better, finding ways to get information in the hands of the consumer, of the worker who is looking for job training, so they can select for a program that is more effective in giving training that graduates then use to get a different high and more high-paying job than they would have gotten otherwise. So that's an unseen part of the Labor Department programs, Gene, but a really important part. I think for those who care about good government, about prudent expenditures of taxpayer dollars, that's part of what we do that I think really does warrant a careful consideration.
Yeah, appreciate that, and appreciate your time here and the chance to hear from you. And thanks not only for this, but for many things you've done over the years. We are delighted to have had the chance to have you here. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gene. A pleasure to join.
Thank you for joining us for this year's Virtual National Lawyers Convention, hosted by the Federalist Society's practice groups. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For other podcasts from the National Lawyers Convention, as well as more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, or to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.